Good morning. On today's programme, how £1 billion has been spent on a UK tunnel which is yet to be built, and conservationists in Slovakia react angrily to plans to cull a quarter of the country's brown bear population. But first we go to Egypt. In 2011, thousands of protesters gathered in Cairo's Tahrir Square to demand the departure of the then President Hosni Mubarak, who'd been in power for almost three decades. Similar anti-regime protests erupted around other countries, including Tunisia, Libya, Syria and Bahrain, events which became known as the Arab Spring. 14 years later, Egypt is under the military rule of Abdel Fattah Sisi and Tahrir Square is heavily policed. Critics say the government is determined to erase all traces of the 2011 revolution from there and the rest of Egypt. Mary Fitzgerald has visited Cairo and sent this report.
It has been years since I last walked around Cairo's iconic Tahrir Square. More than a decade, in fact. The last time I visited the Egyptian capital was before the coup in 2013 that ousted the democratically elected president, Mohamed el-Morsi, and ushered in the military rule of Abdel Fattah Sisi. The government of Sisi, an army general, has now entered its second decade. My strongest memories of Tahrir Square, like many inside Egypt and beyond its borders, are of the heady days of early 2011. Hundreds of thousands gathered here to demand the departure of then-president Hosni Mubarak, who had been in power for almost three decades. Those protests quickly spread beyond the capital and gained such momentum in such a short time that Mubarak was forced to step down within weeks. Anti-regime protests erupted in other countries, including Tunisia, Libya, Syria and Bahrain, leading commentators to dub this the Arab Spring. 14 years later, Egypt and Tunisia have slipped back into authoritarianism, and Libya is fragmented by rival governments and a patchwork of militias. Only Syria appears to have recently recaptured the spirit of 2011, with the fall in December of Bashar al-Assad's regime after years of war. Egypt is a different place now, a place where many complain to me about the pressure on their families amid soaring prices, a place where Sisi's face is everywhere, a place where prominent civil society activists languish in prison while others have gone into exile, a place where few dare to publicly criticize the status quo. Even Tahrir Square feels different. This vast square was named Tahrir, which means liberation in Arabic, after the end of the British occupation in the early 1950s. It has been the site of protests and celebrations ever since, or at least until recent years. Today, Tahrir is heavily policed, like the rest of Egypt, and critics say the government is determined to remove all traces and memories of the 2011 revolution there. Sisi has made clear his views on what happened in 2011. He has argued that the revolution was a death certificate for the Egyptian state and claimed the country had been on the verge of destruction as a result. Tahrir looks different to when I last walked around it. Some surrounding buildings have been demolished and a multi-story car park constructed. There are new security barriers. The Arab League headquarters still stands there, but the Mogamma, an imposing government building overlooking the square, is being turned into a luxury hotel. In 2020, a pharaonic obelisk and four sphinxes from a temple in Luxor were relocated to Tahrir despite the objections of heritage specialists who warned of potential damage due to Cairo's choking pollution. The Egyptian authorities appear determined to turn the space into a tourist attraction devoid of any political or social significance. The redevelopment of the square has cost the equivalent of €9 million. Tellingly, the only time since 2011 when authorities allowed mass protests in Tahrir was in summer 2013, when demonstrations calling for the resignation of Mohamed el-Morsi were followed by Sisi's military coup. Since then, various laws have effectively banned street demonstrations. But despite the government's efforts to erase it from the collective consciousness, Tahrir remains associated with protest. In October 2023, thousands breached security barriers and filled the square to demonstrate against Israel's war in Gaza. As one activist who took part in the 2011 revolution told me, Tahrir will live forever in our hearts. For World Report, this is Mary Fitzgerald in Cairo.
Next, we go to Britain. A project to build the UK's biggest ever road tunnel has finally been given the green light. But agreement to build the route between the counties of Essex and Kent has taken 16 years of discussions and cost more than £1 billion to deal with planning issues before construction has even started. Construction could start next year, and the project is expected to take up to 8 years to complete. It highlights how developing infrastructure is slow and expensive in the UK, as Russell Padmore reports.
The tunnel project, first put forward in 2009, will create a new route to divert freight through the Channel ports away from the M25 crossing at Dartford in Kent, which is regularly gridlocked. I've often been caught in traffic jams at that bridge and tunnel, which crosses the River Thames to the east of London. It is a bottleneck for traffic on the M25, a motorway which circles London for almost 200 kilometres. That point on the M25 was originally designed to handle up to 135,000 vehicles a day, but now it averages 150,000. According to National Highways, the agency that manages British motorways, congestion on the Dartford crossing costs the UK more than £200 million every year. That's about €240 million. So no wonder the government wants to build a new road tunnel to cut traffic delays. Construction could start next year, and the project is expected to take up to 8 years and support 22,000 jobs. Improving the country's ageing infrastructure is a key aim of the government here to revive the UK economy. The Labour government aims to streamline the planning process so that roads and tunnels, new airport runways and more electricity pylons can be built without delay. But overcoming legal challenges to planning is proving costly. Green campaigners or communities trying to protect villages are well versed in creating legal objections or applying political pressure. The Lower Thames Road and Tunnel project has already burned through £1.2 billion, or €1.4 billion, to deal with bureaucracy linked to planning over 16 years. Perhaps the most controversial project here in the UK is the HS2 rail scheme, a line to link London with Leeds and Manchester. The soaring cost, estimated at £80 billion, forced the government to stop the line from London at Birmingham. The inflated cost includes spending £100 million or €120 million to build a shed to house bats, a response to objections by environmental campaigners. These are the kind of planning obstacles the UK government wants to remove with a fast-track process. Experts say it is 10 times more expensive to complete construction projects in the UK. For example, about 2 years ago, the Faroe Islands completed a tunnel 10 kilometres long, linking the two main islands for about the same cost as the money spent by the British just on the planning process for the Lower Thames project. But in most countries, it's almost a given that estimated costs before building starts will soon balloon once digging starts. Ireland is no exception. The Port Road Tunnel in Dublin eventually cost about €800 million, double the original estimate. You can also predict that in a few years, the quality of the construction will cause problems, adding to the cost of operating a tunnel. The Jack Lynch Tunnel in Cork was partially closed overnight for maintenance about one night in four last year. Building the roads and boring the tunnels linking Essex and Kent is forecast to cost £9 billion. Updating infrastructure is a key policy for the ruling Labour Party here. Helping the economy grow by enabling a fast track through planning will be vital to prevent costs of roads, railways, runways and tunnels soaring. The Lower Thames Tunnel project will be a test of the government's policy. After 16 years of overcoming objections and redrafting blueprints, the plan has been given a green light. But the local council on the Essex end is still opposed to it and may yet put up a temporary stop sign. The British government might have to wait longer to see light at the end of the country's biggest road tunnel project. This is Russell Padmore for World Report in London.
Finally, we go to Slovakia, where the country's government has alarmed conservationists after announcing plans to cull one quarter of the country's brown bears following a spate of attacks. The Environment Ministry said 350 of Slovakia's estimated bear population of around 1,300 would be shot after the second fatal attack in 12 months. 2 weeks ago, a 59-year-old man walking in a forest near his home was mauled to death by a bear. Rob Cameron has this report.
Slovakia is a mountainous country and much of it is covered by forest. The spectacular countryside is one of the country's most cherished assets, attracting hikers, mountain climbers and skiers from near and far. But one inhabitant of this small country in the heart of Europe has become an issue of national political significance, pitting the populist nationalist government against the liberal opposition and conservationists. No one knows exactly how many brown bears there are in Slovakia. The last, and in fact first, proper survey was carried out in 2014 when DNA technology helped a team from Prague's Charles University estimate that there were between 1,000 and 1,270 brown bears residing in Slovakia's forests. Slovak bears belong to the wider community populating the Carpathians, Eastern Europe's loftiest mountain range that swings in a wide arc from the western edge of Slovakia through southern Poland, Ukraine, Romania and down to Serbia. Experts believe that figure has stayed the same for decades, perhaps since the 1950s or 60s, after falling to a historic low during the Second World War. They've long been a protected species and, until recently, only problematic individuals that are proven to pose a risk to human life or property can be shot and killed. That was until a spate of high-profile incidents. The first fatal bear attack in Slovakia for a century came in 2021, but since then the number of people wounded or killed by bears has been slowly ticking upwards. In March 2024, after a woman died fleeing a bear in forest, and after a viral video showed a bear bounding through a busy Slovak city in broad daylight, the government decided to act. They declared a special state of emergency in areas close to the Carpathians, allowing teams of hunters to shoot on sight those bears which strayed too close to human habitation. The authorities say a record 93 bears were shot last year as a result, but that hasn't eradicated the problem. 2 weeks ago, a 59-year-old man walking in forest near his hometown of Detva was mauled to death by a bear. The authorities responded by widening the state of emergency to most of Slovakia and announcing a general cull. 350 animals would be shot on sight, it said. We can't live in a country where people are afraid to go into the forest, Slovakia's populist Prime Minister Robert Fico told reporters. But experts say they're ignoring the facts and potentially breaking both Slovak and EU law. For a start, they say, on top of the 93 bears shot by the teams of hunters last year, anywhere between 100 and 200 were probably shot illegally, poached, in other words. A further 40 to 50 died after being hit by cars, so the population is already likely well below the official estimate of 1,270. However, the real problem, and one the government is failing to tackle, they say, are the 20,000 baiting places created by hunters on the edges of Slovakia's forests. These piles of corn and nuts and honey are ostensibly to attract wild boar, part of an ongoing effort to fight an epidemic of swine fever. But it's an open secret, they say, that the bait also attracts bears, who then attack the humans when they approach it. Until that stops, say the critics, the attacks, and maybe the deaths, will continue. Not to mention the likelihood of more shooting means more misses and more wounded and very angry Slovak bears. For World Report, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.